Hello, everyone, and welcome to another fun-filled episode of the Training Tidbits podcast show, brought to you by Animal Training Academy. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm super excited today to be bringing you a guest whom I'm thrilled to have got in contact with recently. I've been consuming their content online over the last wee while and absolutely loving it. They have so much great stuff to get through, and regrettably, I haven't got through all of it just yet, but the stuff I have has formed completely new ways of thinking about things. For me, I just know that today's episode is going to be entertaining, educational, and packed full of inspiration. If you guys haven't listened to the other podcast episodes yet, make sure to check them out at www.animaltrainingacademy.com or on iTunes or the podcast app on your phone. You can just search for Animal Training Academy and you'll find us in there. The aim of this show is to disseminate information about the most positive, less intrusive methods of animal training and behavior management. It's so important that we get the content from this episode and all previous episodes spread as far and as wide as possible. If you could help out with this, that would be super, super appreciated. Tell your friends, peers, family, colleagues, anyone that will listen, and please share this on social media via Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, or wherever you hang out online, and do all of the things to help out. That would be, as mentioned, mega appreciated. But let's move on to today's guest, Carolina Westlund. Carolina grew up pining for a kitten for several years and pestering her parents until they gave up. The green-eyed, black, half Siamese cat that she got for her 7th birthday became a true friend who lived to be 21 years old, but an easily startled cat who often went into hiding when there were visitors and a great teacher for the young Carolina. Carolina had great ideas about becoming a field biologist, but that never came about. The closest she got was working as a nature travel guide in France and Madeira. She studied primate conflict resolution behavior for her PhD, and with this background in primatology combined with behavior analysis, started working with primate behavior management. She is now an associate professor of ethology at the University of Stockholm, with a passion for teaching how behavior management can be used to improve animal welfare. She started presenting her ideas online in late 2015, launching her blog. Nowadays, she offers live workshops, online courses, and free webinars, as well as the occasional blog post. She lives in Stockholm, Sweden, with her husband, two kids, and an ongoing argument as to whether living with a cat is a good idea.
Yeah.
Without further ado, it's my great pleasure to welcome Carolina Westlund to the show today. Carolina, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Ryan.
How's everything?
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and be a guest on the podcast. Everyone listening really appreciates that.
Yeah, really exciting.
How's everything in Sweden today? Connecting with you from New Zealand, is the world between us, as they say.
Yeah, it is. And 12 hours too. It's amazing. Things are great here. I actually went ice skating on the lake yesterday. It was beautiful. The blue skies and perfect ice all over the lake. It was one of those magnificent moments.
Sounds wonderful. Hey, let's dive straight in, Carolina, with our first question. And this is all about the approach you take when teaching about animal behavior and welfare and mixing all the different perspectives or pieces of the behavioral jigsaw puzzle, applied ethology, animal training, behavior analysis, and effective neuroscience. Can you run us through these different lenses we can use to view our animals' behavior and how you combine all of them in the work you do?
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Do we have all day? Very briefly then. So applied ethology is sort of looking through the lens of the animal's evolutionary history, if you will, trying to understand how come they behave like they do as a species. So it's very useful when designing zoo enclosures, for instance. What type of enrichment should that type of species have? How should you set up the social group? How do they get their food? What senses do they use in detecting their food? That kind of thing. So that's my initial background. And then I stumbled on training and I was just blown away by what you can accomplish with good training skills and using positive reinforcement to get animals to cooperate rather than be coerced. And then I learned about behavior analysis, which is essentially, it's looking at behavior in its context and trying to change that context to change the behavior. So understanding what happens before the behavior and what happens after the behavior and how these things collaborate to actually change that behavior. So it's a very good tool if you have problem behavior that you need to solve. What's problematic to you is usually something that's useful to the animal. They're communicating something by doing these behaviors. And then I learned about affective neuroscience and emotions. That was also a very big, important part of the puzzle for me in understanding animal behavior and predicting it. So it just helped me. All these different perspectives really helped me sort of look at behavior from different angles, and they're useful in different contexts, really.
Yeah, great. So for us listening to this podcast, and for those at home, for a pet owner with their dog or their cat or their pet parrot or their rough-throated leaf-tailed gecko, whatever they're working with, where do we start with this information? How do we use all of those different areas to start to work towards implementing better behavior management with our animals?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I think that in a way you could start anywhere, wherever your feet are at, and sort of just look down and see, where are you at? What's the knowledge you have today? And within that area, try to lift your eyes and broaden the horizon. So I find it really useful learning from different people and just hearing their context, because then when they teach, they usually teach from a specific context. So you listen to them and you get those puzzle pieces in that context. And then you move on to someone else, and then you get some more puzzle pieces from that person. And so you sort of build a big jigsaw puzzle by getting all these different pieces from different people. I'm still building my puzzles. I'm by no means finished. I'm still adding things. I was at the conference just the other day where I learned new stuff. Yeah, so it's a continuous journey where we learn more. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this, is I'm passionate about learning more.
And the idea is that there isn't one piece of the jigsaw puzzle of the areas we've talked about, and potentially more areas, that's more important than any of the other pieces. They all, to make up that complete jigsaw puzzle, require each other.
I wouldn't say that they require each other. You can get very far with just one of these lenses, but I think that you get a synergy effect by having several of them. I find that's what I've been doing over the years. So I started out as an ethologist, and I really thought that I knew a lot about ethology and animal welfare. I was quite sure of myself, and I had good self-confidence when I thought, I can help animals have better lives. It was like dropping a bucket of cold water on top of my head when I started learning about training, because I didn't know anything about that. And I realized that, Jesus, I've been missing out on this whole perspective that I don't know anything about. You know, it's just gradually building more and more knowledge. And I'm actually a lot less confident, I think, now than I used to be, because I know how little I know nowadays.
Yeah, an Animal Training Academy member said to me the other day, the more you learn, the less you know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's nice. And I like your metaphor there. One thing we got from a recent podcast episode I did was, there's a melting pot of animal behavior and professionals and ideas. And I think every episode I do, it's like getting a cold bucket of water poured over me.
That was a good thing. You wake up, don't you?
Yeah, feeling very refreshed.
Yeah.
Hey, such great information, and so excited that we are sharing this information today via this episode, a really powerful way for us to move forward looking at our animals' behavior. The next thing I would like to talk about, Carolina, is animal emotions and your viewpoint that they are not taken seriously and how doing so would lead to better outcomes for our animals. Can you please elaborate on this for us?
Yeah, sure. I think that for many people, animal welfare is a lot about their sort of physical health, that they're in good condition, you know, they have good nutrition and just are not ill or unhealthy in some way. There are three types of feelings, really. There's the sensory feelings with, you know, like taste and cold. And there's the bodily feelings of homeostasis, you know, maintaining blood sugar levels at the right level, things like that. So with this health perspective, we ensure that these two feelings are sort of satisfied. But there's a third feeling, which is the emotional feeling, loneliness, fear, joy, anger. And we don't take that very seriously. You know, if you take your dog to the vet will pay a lot of attention to the physical health of your animal, but the dog might be really fearful and the vet just shrugs and say, oh, there's not much we can do about that, or that's just how it is. He'll get over it. And whereas I really feel that it doesn't have to be that way, and it could potentially get a lot worse. So we should be paying attention. We should prevent fear of going to the vets, for instance. And so just looking at some of the advantages of considering emotions, I think, is it can help us better predict behavior. Because if we're only looking like a behavior analyst, we're looking at the context of the behavior. But if we're looking at emotions, we can predict behavior from a mile away. We can say that, well, you know, taking your animal to the vet is likely going to expose it to a lot of fear triggers. And by having that pre-knowledge, rather than waiting for it to happen, we can predict behavior, we can prevent problem behavior, we can prioritize also. If you're taking care of animals in a zoo environment and when you want the animals to show natural behavior, the emotional perspective can help you prioritize what natural behavior, which are important and which are not so important. It can also help us get better precision in our training. If you're a nerd trainer and you want to understand ratios when you're doing training, maybe most people listening are not interested in that, but just understanding emotional states can help you with that. And it can also help you problem solve. But there are some perils also. And I know that some of the behavior analysts are really opposed to labeling the animal, so to speak, you know, saying the animal is angry rather than saying it is chasing or pecking or things like that. So there are, of course, perils in that you think the animal is angry when in fact it's not.
Yeah, interesting. I was wondering if we could elaborate on this a little bit.
Sure.
How do we combine the usage of emotions and viewing the animal's behavior via their emotions with what we learn from behavior analysis?
We can. It's actually easier than you might think, because most of those emotions, they were discovered through some experiments where they subjected animals to little electrical currents that they would run into the brains with an electrode. And what they very soon discovered was that these emotions are not neutral. The animals either are willing to work to get access to them, or they will work to get them to be switched off. So essentially, the emotions are either reinforcing or punishing.
You're really interesting stuff. And potentially that research you just mentioned, could you tell us a little bit more about that and the outcomes of that for what we know now?
Sure. Sure. So this guy, Jaak Panksepp, he's sort of the pioneer in this area, and he coined the term affective neuroscience. And he was laughed at and ridiculed and really had a really hard time sort of getting his ideas across. But the pendulum has swung since then. Anyway, so what he did was essentially he poked electrodes into the brains of different animals, different species, and humans. And he could see that when he was in the same spot in the different brains, so in the homologous places in these different brains, he could generate the same type of emotions or emotional behavior in the case of the animals. So he found one system that's called the seeking system, where animals start showing exploratory behavior. They'll start sniffing and examining and sort of really paying attention to the environment, investigating, showing curious behavior. And people say, when you do the same to people, they'll say they'll feeling really expectant, you know, as if it's Christmas Eve and they have this huge present in front of them and they're really, really curious, can't wait to see what's inside. So that's the seeking system. And then he found a fear system. So whenever he was in that spot in the brains, animals just acted very afraid. And one of the first things that they do is that they start moving slowly and then they freeze. So they become immobile. And then towards the end, they'll sort of flee. And when you talk to people in that situation, they'll say things like, well, they'll act, they'll have facial expressions, and they'll also act and sweat and tell Panksepp or whoever's doing the research that they're feeling really terrified. Then he found five more emotional systems that he could describe, not only the behaviors and what the people, what they were feeling, but he could also pinpoint the neurotransmitters involved in each of these emotional states as well. If you're skeptical and you think, well, you know, I don't think that animals have emotions, or I don't see why we should bother about that. You can sort of think to yourself the what if I'm wrong scenario, rather than what if I'm right. Think, what if I'm wrong? What would be the consequences of being wrong? If you think that animals don't have emotions and you're wrong, so they do, how much guilt would you feel once you realize that, oops, they do have emotions? As opposed to thinking animals have emotions and acting in reference to that idea or that belief, and then understanding that, no, in fact, they don't have emotions.
Yeah, really interesting. And you actually wrote a blog post about this, Carolina, which is on your website. So yep. I'll put a link to this post about the ethical consequences of viewing animal behavior from an emotional perspective. I really like that. And I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast will enjoy it as well. So if you want to learn more about that topic, check out the podcast write up and we'll link to it from there. But such great information. And the next thing I would like to do is build upon something you mentioned at the start there. And that is the fear component. Because we thought we'd discuss a little bit about something you've already mentioned, and that is taking our animals to the vet for checkups and appointments. Can you share your insights, thoughts and feelings, or build upon, I should say, about fear-free approach in veterinary clinics?
Oh, yeah. Oh, don't get me started. This is sort of why I started blogging, or at least the first thing I started writing about was actually fear in the veterinary clinic, because I'd been teaching to veterinarians about some of the techniques used to diminish fear, such as systematic desensitization when you introduce the potentially fearful stimulus gradually, and also counter conditioning when you pair it with something that the animal likes. So you'll show it the needle or the syringe, and then it'll get a treat. And so the syringe, by this repetition of this, the animal will learn that the syringe predicts treats rather than something scary or painful. Anyway, so I was teaching this to veterinarians and vet technicians, and they came up to me afterwards and said, wow, this is really interesting and maybe useful sometimes. But if we get animals to the clinic and we don't know what they've been up to before, we might have to sedate them. And if we have to sedate them, we can't feed them. And I was like, that was so frustrating to me, because I thought that, you know, it's like a catch 22 situation. So what they're saying is that either the animal needs to be fearful but survive anesthesia, or you can reduce that fear through feeding the animal, but then you'd risk the animal's health if you need to sedate them later on. So I started investigating that just to understand this problem more, and I went into the scientific literature and found that the risk of regurgitation due to eating is vastly overestimated. There's no correlations indicating that that would be a risk in the scientific literature. And it seems to me that the problem is the choice of sedative rather than whether the animal has eaten. And if you're doing counter conditioning, you can use really small portions, and it can be like soft and or fluid that passes through the gut more quickly than if you're feeding solids. I actually wrote a scientific paper about this, but I'm glad to see that in certain countries they have a very high level of understanding about this problem with fear in the veterinary clinic. So like in the United States, they're starting to introduce this concept of fear-free clinics, where the vet clinic actually gets certified so that everybody who works there, all the team knows to a certain extent how to work together to prevent and reduce fear in the animals that visit their clinic. This type of reasoning hasn't spread to my country, Sweden, to the same extent. I'll meet individual veterinarians or vet techs who are interested in this, but it's not in the vet schools or in the veterinary organizations yet. So I think it's probably a matter of time, because I think that once people see the benefits of using these types of techniques to reduce fear, you can get a better examination of an animal that's not fearful. You reduce the risk of the personnel involved in handling the animal. You'll reduce the stress in the animal, and you'll reduce the stress in the owner, which is a huge problem that people avoid taking their pets to the vet because it's so terrible, terrifying to some people. seeing their pet fearful like that. And also actually what might happen is that this fear turns into another core emotion, which is rage, and which is when animals start attacking, becoming dangerous.
Is it an educational challenge moving forward? Is it changing culture? What's your perspective on the steps we need to take?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I'm not sure I have the answer to that, but I think one part is we actually need some research on this topic. So there has been a lot of research about the risk of aspiration pneumonia, which is the complication you can get if you're anesthetized and you vomit and you swallow some of that and it gets into the lungs and so you get your pneumonia. And so we know some of the complicating factors surrounding that, but nobody has looked at the level of stress of the animal, for instance. One of the effects of stress is that the gut motility shuts down. So whatever is in the stomach when the animal arrives to the clinic stays in the stomach. Whereas if you start feeding a little to reduce stress, then the gut motility continues. So you could actually end up with an animal, if the animal had eaten breakfast before arriving to the vets, it could actually start processing food more effectively. And we need to actually have solid science backing up. So I'm just putting out an untested hypothesis, and vets are very hesitant to take that as face value. So they don't dare do anything about that until we have the data. But I also think that there's a mind shift and just acknowledging that fear is important to prevent, and just, you know, start at least with the little puppies that come in just to get their puppy shot. You don't expect them to go under any sedation while they're there, right? So there are situations where you know you can estimate that these animals are not going to be sedated or anesthetized, and there are other situations where you might suspect that this animal might have to be given something to calm it.
And so for a lot of people listening to this podcast, if you can find a fear-free vet practice in your vicinity, it's highly desirable to investigate taking
there. Oh, yeah.
If you can't, because you're listening to this podcast, we're making an assumption that you might have already started some of these things that we can implement to make these vet visits less stressful.
Yeah.
So you've started to get your animal used to a vet visit via counter conditioning and positive reinforcement, some of the stimuli it might find there. You get yourself to the vet clinic and the vet says, we have to anesthetize your animal, or we have to restrain it. It's a challenging position to be in as a pet owner.
Very challenging, yeah. I guess that one thing that perhaps might work is if you could bring your pet to the vet when it's not sick. You don't have an appointment, everything is just fine, and you just take your pet to the vet and just lavish treats. Let it rain treats everywhere around the vet clinic, you know, in the waiting room. And if you can, perhaps if you're allowed to, step onto the scales or say hi to some of the personnel in there and just treats, treats, treats. And then you go home again. So that actually affects learning, so that you get what's called latent inhibition. So this, just having this experience of nice things happening at the vets, reduces the risk of fear learning. If on the second time where you arrive with your little puppy and the vet says, we're just going to give him the shot.
Great information, and so much to aspire towards with our animals. And thank you so much for sharing that. Now, the next topic I can't wait to hear your opinion on, and this is something that we've talked about a bit on animal training, especially with horse training in episode 7 with my good friend Kate Southcombe from EPR Training here in New Zealand. And this is negative reinforcement, which you believe has a bad reputation and is heavily misused. Can we discuss this topic?
Sure. Yeah, it's a controversial topic because it involves aversives. So it involves something that the animal will work to avoid or get away from, escape. And it has the potential of being really nasty. If you work with positive reinforcement, you can't go terribly wrong. And I think you can with negative reinforcement. And so what happens is that people avoid talking about it altogether, which means that they don't understand it very well. And I'm generalizing now because I'm sure that many people understand it really well, but I've just come across people not understanding it so well. So negative reinforcement means that the animal performs a behavior in order to remove some aversive stimulus. So there's something in the environment the animal doesn't like. By performing the behavior, that whatever it is disappears. That's the negative of this term, negative reinforcement. And then the reinforcement bit is that the behavior is actually strengthened by this process. And so One of the problems, I think, is that animals learn through negative reinforcement all the time anyway, even unintentional training, if you will. You know, the dog will learn to bark to stop people from coming up to greet them. Or as you discussed, horse training with pressure release training. But I think that sometimes I see people using negative reinforcement without even realizing that that's what they're doing, such as when they're chasing animals from one enclosure to the other, for instance. And some of the things that I see people going wrong there is that their timing is off. So the animal will start moving, but the person will keep following or keep approaching rather than making sure that the distance is actually increased as the animal is doing the right behavior, walking away. Another problem, and a huge one, I think, is that people use way too aversive stimuli, very often going in this type of training or just, you know, just moving animals, not in pressure release training with horses, but just, you know, moving animals in a zoo setting, for instance, is that they use really aversive stimuli. They'll wave their arms and shout and stare at the animals. And so they're evoking a fear response. And also they don't give any warning signals. So it's the animal performs an escape response rather than just avoiding the stimulus. And it's not that I'm promoting negative reinforcement to move animals in a zoo. I'm just saying that this is what I observe sometimes, that people use these types of techniques and very inexpertly. I can think of basically one type of situation where I wouldn't hesitate to use negative reinforcement, and that is with frightened animals. So like I've worked a little on feral cats, feral kittens, and also monkeys that are sort of afraid or that move away from people. And in this case, I think negative reinforcement is a really, really nice tool that you can use to very quickly get the animals more confident and in control of the situation and actually walking towards you, because they can move towards you or do behaviors that you want to see more of. And when they do, you move away. So you give them distance when they do behaviors that you want to see more of. So in this case, you can quite quickly get a lot more confidence in animals because they know that they can get you out of their space. And if you add positive reinforcers to this equation, so you add treats, that transition can be really quick. And you can use also systematic desensitization so that you don't step out into their space really close from the start, but you stand ways from the animal when you start, but you're moving away contingent on their behavior every time. So I think that's a very refined and humane use of negative reinforcement that actually beats just simple habituation. If you just stand there until the animal looks calm and then you take a step forward. But instead, if you back off when the animal does the right thing, you're actually giving them more control.
I think the takeaway message from me, and interested to hear your opinion on this, is it really comes down to just understanding what's going on. And understanding that behavior quadrant and really developing the lens that you're seeing behavior through and seeing it for what it is. Is that where you think we start for someone who is not quite experienced?
You know, there's a huge community out there who would be willing to help. One thing you could do could be to film the situation and just look at it yourself, because you learn so much from watching yourself on film with animals and just see what they do, what you do, and how they respond to what you do. So that's a great start. And I wouldn't hesitate to ask for help, have people watch that film or watch the training session with you and discuss with you how should I go about, you know, if you have like a dog that's afraid of children, how should you go about using distance as a reinforcer for that animal to make it more confident around children?
And fully going to utilize this opportunity to plug the Animal Training Academy forums. If you do want a really safe place full of amazing animal trainers that is set up for this exact purpose, where for a few click of the buttons, you can easily embed your videos in there and you can get other trainers to come along and add their thoughts and feelings from a safe place where no one's going to judge you. We're all there to brainstorm and work together and help you out. So if you're interested in getting access to that space, then you can send me a private message and I will give you some more information.
I'm interested.
And we're gonna invite Carolina in there as well. I'm gonna set her up with some access. So here's an opportunity for you to interact with myself and with amazing minds like Carolina's as well. So if you're interested in that, go to www.animaltrainingacademy.com, click on the contact page on the website, send me a message, and we'll get you organized to get in the forums. But we'll move on, because this podcast is not about the Animal Training Academy forums. It is about Carolina. So great to have a conversation about that subject and negative reinforcement, the behavior quadrant, an area for us all to spend time learning about, and one we never stop learning about. Now, though, I must regrettably inform you, we are sadly heading towards the end of this podcast. However, I'm excited because it is story time. Carolina, could you please think back through your career and share two or three stories that really stick out in your mind from your experience and highlight some significant lessons you've learned along the way?
This was a hard one for me, but I think that if you're asking for one really significant lesson, I think I already mentioned it, and it's actually learning humility, learning that there's actually more to learn and sort of being on this continuous journey of discovering new things and getting this mind shift several times during my career has been very sobering experience and sometimes even painful. It's more like a discovery, really, like, you know, like opening up a new module, like going to the movies and just seeing something completely new that you've never seen before. To me, it's been, you know, I read Temple Grandin's books, Animals in Translation, and she was on the one that put me on the path of finding Parksep and these core emotions and their influence on behavior. And it's just realizing that what I carry with me, what's formed me and the knowledge I have, some of it's wrong. And just realizing that, I've been wrong all my life about this. And also when I first started learning about training, I was very influenced by some people, and they all said with one voice that negative reinforcement is wrong. You should never, ever use that, more or less. I'm paraphrasing now. But then sort of discovering this, that, well, actually, with these frightened animals, negative reinforcement is a great approach. And just having to rethink and realizing, oh, I was wrong about that, and realize I'm probably wrong about other things too that I don't know about. And that, you know, 5 years from now, I might look back at this podcast and go, oh, I wish I'd known. Oh, not liking the sound of what I'm saying right now, perhaps. I don't know. So it's just learning to be humble about and change, and just accept that the ground is constantly shifting and you need to shift with it.
Yeah, and that you're human and you don't have the answers for everything.
Yeah, sure. And I thought I had the answers. That was the problem. I was very cocky and confident. I thought I did have the answers.
That is a lot of pressure to put on yourself.
Yeah.
So great. And thank you for sharing that, Carolina. We do have one last question now. And I was hoping for this one, you could please take us into the future and share what you would like to see happen in the next 5 to 10 years in the animal care world.
Just something I've been thinking a lot about lately is that currently there's a lot of animosity between different training camps. So people from different training schools, different orientations, are spending a lot of time getting frustrated and annoyed with each other. So I would wish that we could learn to communicate better, not be so hostile in our discussion, because I think that hostility prolongs the problem and makes it worse, actually. So I think that by establishing this communication, we can start exchanging ideas rather than be defensive about what we do. And actually, I wrote a blog post about how we could talk about what we do in an effective way to speed up how people learn about animal training and transfer them into the camp that is all about positive reinforcement training.
Yeah, wonderful. And we'll link to that latest blog post as well in podcast writer if you want easy reference to that. And you did share with me a technique just before the podcast that I really loved. It was innovative, creative, and can't wait to have my brain pick up on this more moving forward. Can you just discuss this idea of using memes?
Yeah, sure. It's just that some things that influence people's perception of things, of the world, is something called mere exposure. So just by being exposed to something, you start liking it. And also having something repeated also means that you start showing a preference for that. So that's how advertisers get us to buy their stuff, is by exposing us to the brand. So we start preferring that brand as compared to other brands. And one way I think of doing that would be to use what's called memes. So often very short sentences that describe what we do as animal trainers in just a few words. So one meme would be focus on what you want. So rather than focusing on what you don't want, you focus on what you want. And you use only those words, those five words, focus on what you want. And you repeat those. Focus on what you want. Focus on what you want. So different people are using the same expression so that people from other camps are exposed to that. So they hear it over and over again and they start thinking, they start internalizing that. And so if we could use this on social media, like on Facebook or something, and we could share these expressions, we do expose other people to that, and that will change, that will shift them into another frame so we can talk to them about what we do rather than them being defensive.
Interesting area, one that we can talk about for a significant long period of time. Does anyone own that focus on what you want meme? Is that a Carolinaism?
No, it's not. I'm not sure who I heard that from first, but Teresa McKeon said it on the WOOF conference that I just attended over this weekend.
Wonderful. And let's hope that these things transpire. Carolina, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule today, out of movie time with your family to do this podcast recording. It's been so much fun. And I know everyone out there listening is just going to be taking so much away from this. Bucket loads of gratitude to you, Carolina. And just before we go, can you just tell everyone out there listening where they can go to find out more information about you, what you do, and maybe subscribe to your email list or however you maintain connection with your audience?
Yeah, I have a homepage. It's www.illis.se/en. But I will put a link in there somewhere, I'm sure.
And what does the illis stand for? I was always wondering that.
It's nothing. It's Latin and it means them or they. So it's like the animals.
I like it. And when they get to your website, they can read your blog posts and find out about...
I'm not very good at talking about upcoming events and things like that, but I have a few blog posts, and I'm starting to put courses up there as well. There's a little introductory course to these emotions there, for instance.
Nice. And they can also join your mailing list there, can't they?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much, Carolina. We're going to head towards the end of the podcast now, but...
Yeah.
On myself and on behalf of
thank you so much.
Yeah, it's
thank you so much for having me.
Like I said, it's been a lot of fun, and I hope that you out there listening have enjoyed this episode as much as we have enjoyed making it. And the information contained within the contents of this episode is, as mentioned, super important, and we would be really appreciative if you could do your part in helping this podcast achieve its mission of reaching as many eardrums around the world as possible. Please share this episode and all others as far and as wide as you possibly can. Facebook is a great place to do it. Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, or email it to your friends. However you can, the more people we can get listening to this great information, the more we will be ever moving towards our goal of changing animals' lives world over. For now though, that's it from this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. So long, and thanks for all the fish.